This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is songwriter Ellie Greenwich, who co-wrote many of the girl group hits of the 1960s, including these. The songs we just heard were co-written by Ellie Greenwich and Jeff Barry, who were briefly married. With the exception of Chapel of Love, which Greenwich and Barry co-produced, all the records we heard were produced by Phil Spector, the first real genius of pop production. Ellie Greenwich didn't write exclusively for the girl groups. I'll name a few more of her songs and the performers that recorded them. Leader of the Pack by the Shangri-Las, I Wanna Love 'Em So Bad, The Jelly Beans, River Deep, Mountain High, Ike and Tina Turner, Maybe I Know, Leslie Gore, I Can Hear Music, The Beach Boys, and Doo Wah Diddy, recorded by Manfred Mann. Greenwich was one of the few women to break into pop songwriting in the early 60s. She got her start when she was hired as a staff writer by the songwriting team of Lieber and Stoller. She worked out of the Brill Building, which was headquarters to many of the top 40 songwriters and producers in the 60s. When the British invasion took over the charts and groups started performing their original material, a lot of songwriters ended up out of work. Greenwich spent most of the 70s writing advertising jingles. The 80s brought a resurgence in her career. She's written for Cyndi Lauper, Irene Cara, and Clarence Clemens. She performed in the recent Broadway review of her songs called Leader of the Pack. The show introduced her to listeners who never stopped loving her songs but never knew who wrote them. I asked Greenwich about one of the first hits that she co-wrote and co-produced, Chapel of Love.
That song had originally been cut by the Ronettes. Phil Spector had cut it with the Ronettes but never put it out. Why? Do not ask me. And we always believed in that song. We knew it had to be a a spring release or a summer release because of the nature of, you know, Chapel getting married, June weddings, the whole thing. And what happened was when they did not put that, when Phil Spector didn't put that record out, Jeff and I said, we have to do something with it. And just at that time, a gentleman named Joe Jones came up from New Orleans with a whole slew of people. Amongst them was three girls, which we eventually named the Dixie Cups. And here were all these singers just hanging out at the office, you know, Lieber and Stoller's office. And we said, girls, come here a minute. And we went to the piano, and we played it for them, and they sang. So it's very, I mean, anybody could sing Chapel of Love, you know? And we said, we have to go in and make this record. And it's funny, in my whole career of being in the studio producing, there were only two songs that I literally walked out of a studio and said, either these records are going to be zippity-doo, nothing, go nowhere, or number one records. That was Chapel of Love and Leader of the Pack.
When you were all scouting for girls to sing the songs that you were writing and for new groups that you could do, how important was image and the way they looked?
Well, it's funny. Back then, today where everything is so, well, with the videos, I mean, everything is image and every song is put into a category. It's urban contemporary, it's this, it's, you know. Then we didn't label anything. The first thing was, do they have a sound? Secondary was, gee, if they happen to look a certain way, that might be helpful. But it didn't really matter.
Did you have a special rapport with the singers and the girl groups being a woman yourself?
I think initially, it's funny, back then, because I was so involved in the productions and working on the background vocals and what have you, I was not just, well, here's my song, see ya. I got involved in everything. And it wasn't that accepted back then, a female being in that end of the business. A songwriter, a lyricist, automatic acceptance. A background singer, automatic acceptance. A writer, because Carole King and I were really the only female writers then that I know of that actually sat at the piano and sang the song and really got involved. And that wasn't, because there were so few of us that, you know, it was sort of like looked on and you know, walked away from a little bit. But what happened was eventually the girl said, gee, we have someone we can really relate to, somebody we can talk to. We have headaches today. We want to tell somebody who's going to understand better than Ellie. So at first it was like, well, who does she think she is giving us orders here or telling us what to do? But on the other end, if you just were very open with them, they saw they could be your friend. And then it became an asset to be a woman dealing with the girl groups.
What were some of the problems that you had breaking in and getting accepted, being a woman? Because as you just pointed out, there really weren't many women songwriters in the early 60s.
Well, I think I was very fortunate in that most of the early things I got involved in became hits. So what choice did so many of these people have when I said, well, hey, you know, I have a little track record here. This was a hit, and this is doing well on the charts, and I'm doing, you know, and it was almost like, well, we don't love, you know, like the musicians would say, we don't love a woman telling us to go like this on your guitar, but I said, look at me as the thing. Forget, you know, and I think because of my success, it made it a little easier. Plus, I did a lot of co-producing with Jeff, so I had the little male protector on one side, you know? So I think the combination of the success and having Jeff there, they really didn't have much of a choice, did they?
What was your technique for writing songs together?
Very often we would get ideas separately and then come to one another with our ideas. We would generally have title first and write what we call our hook line or our chorus. Sometimes I played piano. Sometimes Jeff would play piano. Once again, both of us doing both, sometimes we would actually both sit down at the piano and like almost kill each other because I'm playing one thing, he's playing another. But we did complement each other, and we found a way for some reason that the songs just happened with us. It was the most natural, with whomever I've written with since, Jeff and I still had the most natural writing partnership that I've ever experienced.
You got married to each other, and you know, after all, you'd written songs like Chapel of Love. You were writing all these Today I Met the Boy I'm Gonna Marry, all these great love and wedding songs, Not Too Young to Get Married. Did you think that you were gonna have a marriage that was everything that the song said marriage was gonna be?
Well, I have to like flee in on something. I grew up in Levittown, Long Island, on the corner of Starlight and Springtime Lane. You tell me if I thought my marriage was... Yes, I did. I really believed in the little house with the white picket fence and together forevermore, and absolutely believed that I was really a dreamer. And I think that still can happen. Unfortunately, it didn't happen for us, and I think that was partly the business sport. But yes, I was very much a hopeful romantic.
My guest is Ellie Greenwich. How did you hook up with Phil Spector?
Oh, this is about a four-hour show. No. I had, at the time, I was writing with a guy named Tony Powers before I was writing with Jeff. And I was not yet signed to Lieber & Stoller, but I was on what they call a first refusal basis, where I would go, I could use their offices as long as whatever I wrote, they heard first and had first choice whether they wanted it or not. They called me and told me that there was a guy coming up to the office who was cutting the Paris sisters, and did I have something for them? I said, sure. And I went to the office that day, and I'm there, and I'm nervous, and I'm playing my tune. It was Me Yesterday. He never cut it. This person comes walking in with ruffles, and he's wandering around the room making noises, looking in the mirror. I mean, he was an eccentric human being. Very lovable once you got to know him and work with him, but initially it's sort of like, what is this? Rude to the point of, I kept stopping saying, do you want to hear my song or not? And by the fourth time of him wandering around and making noises and not listening, I got annoyed, and I slammed on the piano, and I said, forget it. And he's like, you don't tell Phil Spector, forget it. And he went storming out of the office. And Lieber & Stoller came running, and like, what did you do? I said, who was that? I said, that was the most humiliating thing I've ever, I'm singing my heart out, I'm scared to death here. And this guy goes, like, he didn't even listen to me. That was the first meeting with Phil Spector. Then I played Lieber & Stoller shortly thereafter a song called Today I Met the Boy I'm Going to Marry, which they didn't like. And after three times of playing, I said, nah, take it wherever you want. And I brought it to a publisher named Aaron Schroeder. Aaron says, I love it. I want it. I think I know someone perfect to cut this song. And 2 weeks later, he calls me. He goes, we have a meeting. I want you to go to 62nd Street and meet with Phil Spector. I said, does he know who's going to meet with him? And Phil had money, but he didn't connect it with being at Lieber & Stoller. We had a 2 o'clock appointment. I got there at 2 o'clock. He showed up at 6. And I waited the 4 hours, seething. He walked in, and he took one look at me, and I went, we started off so wrong. And we had it out. I said, if I didn't want this record, I would never have sat here, but I want this record. I think this will be a great song. Blah, blah, blah. Went through it. I said, don't you ever be late again, and don't you make those noises. You listen to me. And he was so taken with the fact that I was like, I mean, I was doing this hysterically, though. I mean, like, I was so upset. But yet I sort of tongue-in-cheeked it because I didn't want to get too serious. We hit it off so perfectly. And that was the beginning of our working relationship. We worked together all the time. And I was married to Jeff Barry, so I figured, So I brought Jeff in, and then the three of us just really hit it off and just wrote a bunch of songs together.
You were talking about working with Phil Spector and how crazy he was. What's an example of Spector at his craziest?
And I say crazy with tenderness and with respect. I really must clarify that because people, she called him crazy. He was just so eccentric. And I guess I was so conventional and, you know, from Levittown, Long Island, and, you know, everything was by the book, that anything would have been like a little off. So he was really out there. I think the craziest thing Phil did that I was privy to was going to a recording session once where he had all his musicians wore short sleeve pink shirts with Phil Spector written on it, and stood up and saluted him when he walked in the room. And because most of the artists he cut were black artists, he had everybody stand before the session and sing We Shall Overcome before the date was started. I found that a little, you know, crazy and weird. Also, veering away from the actual studio experiences, we had spent like 3 or 4 days in California writing stuff together, and Phil was petrified of flying. And it was time to come back to New York, and Phil caused such a scene on the plane that people thought it was a bomb scare, and the plane had taken off, came back, and landed. We were searched. I figured my parents are going to see me in the paper in jail. They're not going to believe this. But Phil purported to have a heart attack and carried on so crazily, but they said, we got to turn this plane back. And they said, there's this maniac on the plane who's carrying on. So Phil would do things that were just not, you know, overly accepted, especially back then. He was filled with antics. Phil was filled with antics.
One of the big hit songs that you wrote was Leader of the Pack, which you co-wrote. And it was performed by the Shangri-Las, who I always think of as being the tramps of the girl groups, because they had such a tough
You think
image.
They would trampy in the Ronettes? I mean, Terry, please.
Oh. How did you get to work with those Shangri-Las?
Well, there was a guy that I knew named George Morton, whom we, because he was also one that was a little eccentric and like would never show up on time, so we ended up calling him Shatter Morton. So George calls me. He has this tape and a bunch of girls he wants me to hear. Brought the tape to the office, and this thing went on. He did this male narration. It was 7 minutes long. I said, no, we can't do that. But there was something very interesting in this song. Different. I said, who is this singing? This thing like the... You know, I said, wow, it's a very different sound. Saw a picture of them and said, see, that there's where... What an added thing. What an interesting-looking little group here. And met with them, and the record came out. Big hit. It's now time for a follow-up. So Shadow said, we got to write something together. And at that time, when you made money, you bought yourself boots or motorcycles. I mean, that was really what it was all about. So everybody, every male, Jeff, Shadow, the engineer, the arranger, they all had motorcycles, and they were always riding motorcycles. I said, why don't we do something with motorcycles? Okay, we can call it. There's always a leader. So the head of the group. I said, no, it doesn't sound good. And we just threw titles around. Leader of the Pack sounded important. And Shadow Morton also had a habit of writing little soap operas. His songs all became these little mini soap operas, right? So with his influence, we were, you know, we melodically did certain things, whatever. And he had to have this, had to be a sick song. Let's get, and Jeff had written Tell Laura I Love Her. So he was used to being about with the sick element. This was new for me. I said, hey, as long as it's not too disgusting and I can deal with it. So I think we had everything from the sound effects to motorcycles to boy loving, you know, the girl loving the boy that's forbidden. I mean, all of these, death, my God. I mean, it was like everything was in there. And once again, like I said, and there's the way Mary sounded, the way the whole group looked. I thought the picture was a perfect picture and the record was just the perfect kind of a thing to be a top record.
Why don't we hear it? Okay.
Okay.
This is Leader of the Pack, co-written by my guest Ellie Greenwich and performed by the Shangri-Las.
Is she really going out with him?
Well, there she is. Let's ask her.
Betty, is that Jimmy's ring you're wearing?
Mm-hmm.
Gee, it must be great riding with him. Is he picking you up after school today?
Mm-mm.
By the way, where'd you meet him? Yes, we see.
That's when I fell for
the leader of the pack.
My folks were always putting him down.
Down, down.
They said he came from the wrong side of town.
What do you mean when you say that he came from the wrong side of town?
They told me he was bad.
Small, he kissed me goodbye. The tears were beginning to show. As he drove away on that rainy night, I begged him to go slow. What he heard, I'll never know.
I felt so helpless, what could I do? Remembering all things we've been through. In school they all stop and stare. I can't have her tears, but I don't care. I'll never forget him,
the leader of the pack.
Mm-hmm.
It really still sounds great.
It's fun, isn't it?
It really is. How did you decide to get in the screeching wheels and the motorcycle revving up, all the sound effects? Why did you decide
to
put it in?
We had to. Uh-huh. I mean, how could you have a song about a motorcycle without a motorcycle sound in it? I mean, that was half the record. The gimmick. That was the gimmick part of the record.
Rock music was the music of rebellion, and it really separated children from their parents. Because parents were listening to Steve and Edie Gourmet, and the kids were listening to your records. But you were from the suburbs. You were from Levittown.
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel like you had to act a little tougher than you really were in
no.
order to fit in, or anything like that?
No, I was not. I was not a rebel, and I'll never be. No, any good. No. I didn't feel I had to prove anything or be that different or whatever. I just, first of all, once again, most of the songs that I had the hits with were very romantic, nice songs. I mean, you know, my most off-color song was Hanky Panky, you know, and when people say, and yet my baby does the Hanky Panky, she dances, she this, she kisses me, whatever you want it to mean. I left the door wide open. I never said it, you know?
Did your parents like your songs?
Funny. My parents, may they rest in peace, were very supportive of what I wanted to do. Didn't quite understand what it was. When my mom used to tell her friends, like, well, you know, my daughter's a songwriter, they would say, well, gee, we're really sorry. So she changed the term to, well, my daughter's in musical productions. Well, that's just wonderful. Then it made more sense to them, you know? And what happened was, because I started having success so early, they were very, of course, fearful, like, what was she going to get into when this, they've heard such stories about the music business, the industry so crazy. But, I mean, I am level-headed, you know, and they did see that. And they were very happy for my success because I was very happy with it. I mean, I was doing my first love. I was earning a living at it, you know. I was married. I mean, I had the whole, all bases covered at that time in my career. So they were very happy for me, really, very proud.
How much did you, when you were starting, and did the groups that you wrote for really know about love and sex?
We really knew very little. We really were, as we said, that, you know, the good girls, and we just knew what we read and we knew what we fantasized about, and our experiences really were very limited. But you could if you don't write about what you've experienced, you certainly can write about fantasy, so it comes out the same way.
What were some of the changes in the music industry that made songwriters almost superfluous for a while, that there was just no business for songwriters for a while?
Well, you know the answer to that one. The British invasion was what really killed most of the independent songwriters. I mean, at that point, there came all the self-contained groups who wrote for themselves and produced. A lot of them did their own producing. For the independent songwriter, where were you going to take your song? Plus, the few people that were out there, such as like the Leslie Gores and certain people that were still recording but like didn't always write their own stuff, and most of them didn't write, they were having a hard time getting played. It was now time for self-contained groups, the British invasion, and males. Males became real. So there go the girl groups. There go a lot of the female singers. Here come a bunch of males, groups, and, you know, solos who are writing for themselves, and we're going, oh, boy, we are in trouble. One of the things that did happen, fortunately for both Jeff and I, were I discovered a guy named Neil Diamond. And at that time, we opened up a company called Talleyrand Music, and Neil naturally wrote for the company. And Jeff and I co-produced all his early records for Bang Records. So we were not now writing for people, but we were producing and had a little company, and we had our own self-contained person. And Neil had that's when his career started. It was like in the mid-60s, 66, 67 in there. So if we couldn't do it that way, the next best thing was okay, and we happened to find someone we believed in and went with it. So we sort of fit into that little mold of that time with what was happening. But as writers, it was a killer, a real killer.
Did people start to fall apart during that period, songwriters?
I think a lot of them did. I think a lot of them started in with the drugs heavily at that point, and very angry group of people.
What did you do? What was that period like for you?
I panicked, to tell you the truth, and what I did do was I was smart enough to realize that there were other areas that I could possibly, just to get over this this new thing that is coming in, which I knew would last for a while, but once again, something else would happen. It always does. And I got involved in doing jingles, commercials, writing some spots and singing on them. And that wasn't what, you know, I didn't feel totally alive like writing songs and doing what I did made me feel. But it did eke out a living, and it did allow me to still do my music. The 70s for me was not my best time. And I didn't go to drugs and I didn't go to alcohol, but I did fall apart.
Do you think that songwriters are coming back again, that there's more of a demand for songwriters?
I should. As a matter of fact, with the advent of certain things happening in the 80s, like having written with Cyndi Lauper, who was very much into like the song. The song is real important to her, which is what it was in the 60s. It's not like, well, how much of a track we have here and how many synthesizers. That happens. But the main thing is, got to hear that song. People want that again, which I think that suits me fine.
So you're working as a songwriter again.
Yes, yes. My first love, yes.
You've also gotten a new career as a performer through the review of your songs, Leader of the Pack. Were you surprised at seeing the emotional involvement that people still have with the songs that you wrote back in the 60s?
I could honestly say it was the most heartwarming. When you say shocked, was surprised, yeah, I would say, my God, these songs were like, then, why are they so crazy now? Because the importance of those songs, I mean, they remembered what they wore, where they were. This one met her husband to this song, but divorced them to that song. And another one of my songs, they remarried. I mean, you should see the letters I got. And the fact that now that I was exposed, I was in the open, they can come directly to me. They would wait backstage and I'd come out. I mean, tears. Thank you. Thank you. And I'm like, whoa. I mean, I go home like, it would blow my mind. But isn't that great that music can do that? For so many people, it was quite a revelation, and very, 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 they were very sincere, and it made me feel real good, really good.
That was songwriter Ellie Greenwich. The songs she co-wrote include Be My Baby, Da Do Run Run, Chapel of Love, and Leader of the Pack. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The engineers for this edition were Jay Goldman and Joyce Lieberman. Fresh Air is edited by Maeve McGoran. Amy Salad is the associate producer. Danny Miller and I co-produce the show. My name's Terry Gross. I want to thank you for listening.
This edition of Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order a cassette of this interview or for a listing of other Fresh Air programs available on cassette, call toll-free 800-253-0808. In Alaska and Wisconsin, call 608-263-4892. The number again for a cassette of Fresh Air is 800-253-0808. National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible with the financial support of listeners to WHYY-FM, Philadelphia. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.